I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mike Spencer Bowen joins me now. He is the world's most traveled man, which is the title of his new book. It looks at the 23 years he spent traveling the world and seeing every country. He's not traveling for social media. In fact, he started before the advent of social media. He's not merely counting countries, but as he's visiting them, he's immersing himself in them. He's living and eating amongst the people. And along the way, he's been arrested and visited some terribly dangerous places. I'll get him to tell us about some of the 196 countries he's visited and more. The book is called The World's Most Traveled Man, a 23-year odyssey to and through every country on the planet. It's published by Douglas & McIntyre. No single place is home to Mike, though he was born in Alberta, and he joins me from Canmore today. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Mike Spencer Bowen. Mr. Bowen, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So in 1990, that's the year that you started, I guess, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I've been backpacking since 1990.
Yeah, so what was happening? I mean, first of all, did you set out to do every country in the world at the time, or did it just happened over the years?
Well, at first I was more interested in ecosystems than the world itself, because I used to live in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd go up and just live off the land, and I think the most I ever stayed was 86 days without seeing another human or speaking.
Yeah.
But I was so knowledgeable then about North American ecosystems, and I got thinking about what it would be like in deserts or jungles or things like that. But once I got traveling, I was so fascinated with reality, I suppose, that I thought it was just so interesting to learn about the real ways and means of things, that it just kept me fascinated for long enough that it's now been 26 years of backpacking.
Yeah, and so, I mean, there are people like you that do this, but they're unlike you in the sense that they're just counting how many countries they can get to.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, especially recently. So I know a bunch of the country counters.
Yeah.
I don't mind to talk to them. I mean, mostly you talk about visa procedures with these guys, but what they're trying to do, and even some of the ones are in the news, like that guy who did the world by walking in only 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Well, one of my friends saw him doing Bhutan, and what he did is he went up and he slipped a few dollars to the guard and said, "Can I put my boot across the border?" And he said, "Okay," and then he put it across the border, and then we got a stamp, and off he went. So, yeah, but I'm not interested in that kind of travel. That seems more like transportation to me, or more like some kind of publicity stunt, whereas I want to go in and, talk to the people, eat the food, and especially, like, do some freestyle adventures, just see what happens. You know, if someone suggests something interesting, just go off and do it.
Yeah, that's what's admirable about you, is that you do live amongst the people and not touristy as much.
Yeah, well, I think it's the best way to travel. I mean, it's the only way that I really look at the definition of travel. I don't see this transportation-related stuff as that much traveling. I mean, there's a few hundred other people. Maybe it used to be 100. There's probably about 200 now who've also done all the countries.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them are airline pilots or stewardesses or things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just kind of getting out of the plane.
Yeah, it's a little easier for them, I guess, than say...
Yeah, well, even that woman who was claiming to be the first woman to visit all the countries, it wasn't really true, because I know some extremely adventurous women who have visited all the countries. But she made this claim because I guess it was the first one documented through whatever corporation she was running through. So she found a weaselly way to say that she was the first. But I had another friend who watched her do Tuvalu, which is that banana-shaped country in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah.
And the plane landed, and she just got off the plane and took a selfie, and then she got back on the plane and flew to the next country. And
so,
I was thinking, oh, no.
When you started in 1990, social media wasn't around. So it must be fascinating to see, or horrifying at the same time, to see how that has evolved into our culture.
Yeah,
it's
starting to be a different kind of traveler now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had one example of that where, you know, once in Burma, in order to make a phone call, I had to go deep into the jungle and then deeper and deeper until what was the no man's land between the Shan rebels and the Burmese army. And to make a phone call there, I had to go down into some quite wet dirt tunnel with a few bare bulbs lighting it and use this archaic black telephone that was from the 1930s and had the rotary dial on it. And I found out later from a Chinese buyer of blood rubies that this phone was used by the British during World War II. To keep contact with their forces that were fighting the Japanese in the jungle. And they just kept it up, and that was the only phone in that area at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is the early 90s or something like that. And now, of course, you know, everyone has a smartphone.
Yeah. Eating the food and living amongst the locals, I mean, do you drink the water in most of these places?
I try to drink the water as less as possible, because I found I typically came down with Giardia about once every year or two.
Mm.
Yeah, and also a few other illnesses. I mean, I tried to do as much as I could to protect myself, short of actually taking prophylactic drugs.
Yeah.
But I did end up with two malarias, the falciparum, the lethal kind.
Yeah.
And what I suspect was one Zika as well.
Really? Yeah. And so throughout these 26 years, you'd come back from time to time to Canada, right?
Yeah, I would come back, like, sometimes around Christmas. Like, unless Christmas was in, you know, everyone was meeting in some other country.
Yeah.
I'd come back for that. And when my brothers had kids, you know, I came back to see them a little bit. I had to make sure that I wasn't some unknown Uncle Mike that they don't even know the name of. So I did have to come back every so often.
And
so
it,
I try to come back once every year or once every 2 years for a couple of weeks at least.
There's a poignant moment in the book where your mom comes down with cancer.
Yeah, that's the traveler's worst nightmare. Is you know, you haven't been in contact for quite a while. Some weeks pass, and then you look at your email, and it's like cancer, and then first chemo, second chemo, like these kind of messages in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I talked to her, and she said I shouldn't even stop my trip because I planned this very difficult leg through Africa. Now, you know, I'm not sure how long it was now, like 8 months or maybe it was a year, but she said don't stop it because I was getting toward the end anyway, and I guess it's what's done is done, so you know her chemo would either save her or not.
Yeah.
And luckily the hospitals were quite effective and she managed to survive, and now she's doing fine.
They live out here, don't they?
Yeah, they're actually visiting now in Canmore, but normally they're out near Boundary Bay.
Right, right. Well, what's that like though? I mean, you described already a moment ago about being remote, traveling, and someone at home is sick like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a bad feeling where you think, oh, I should have been there. But I think in order to accomplish my dream of seeing the whole planet and, you know, having adventures in every country and thoroughly seeing them all, that it was necessary that I go for these sometimes, you know, it was a half-year trip or a year trip or a year-and-a-half trip. And it's kind of necessary, otherwise it gets too expensive.
Right.
Because if I was to be rushing back to Canada whenever there was something of importance going on and even a medical emergency, it would be more money than I can afford. You know, I'm trying to do things on a very budget level because I only worked about 1/20th of the time or at most 1/10th of the time. And, you know, 90-95% of the time I'd be backpacking.
Yeah, so you lived, you learned to live, you know, sparsely.
Yeah, and I became, like, people might expect that I'd be a really good, like, knowledgeable as a tourist, but I'm actually not. I'm more knowledgeable as a traveler. Like, for instance, I would be the world's worst hotel inspector. Yeah, here's an example from Chad.
Yeah.
You know, I checked into this one hotel, and it was a fairly nice room. I mean, nothing that would pass inspection in Canada. It would probably be shut down as some sort of, health risk. But for there, it was fairly good, except for the toilet was infested with these gigantic ants. They were a couple inches long, and they had these huge mandibles clacking on them. And they lived inside of the porcelain toilet. So when you flush, they boil out, and they try to, like, sink their mandibles into your ass. So you had to jump out of the room and slam the door. You could hear them skittering against the door, right?
Yeah.
And later, you know, later after the Chad trip, someone else was going there, and he asked for a recommendation. And I recommended the hotel. And then I told him about the ants. And he said, I thought you said you recommended the hotel. And I go, yeah, well, apart from the carnivorous ants infesting the toilet, it's actually a pretty good hotel.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that struck me as I was reading the book is just how dramatically travel has changed, not only because of social media, but because of 9/11. Did you feel that as you were traveling?
Yeah, it used to be, you know, even coming out of Vancouver, you know, you used to have to travel with cash.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be traveling with cash as well. And it used to be coming out of Vancouver, flying to Asia. No one really cared. You know, you had some cash on you. But now people are very cautious about that. And I started getting stopped a lot more at airports. So, for instance, Heathrow was the worst, but I had some other examples.
Uh-huh.
Like Heathrow, once they kept me for 9 hours, once for 7, a few times for 5 hours. And it wasn't so much the police as the immigration people. But I was even joking with them, saying if I knew them any better, I'd have to send them Christmas cards. You know, because they'd start out with accusing me of being a terrorist because I fit some sort of profile.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually they let me go. And now I think I'm on file for Heathrow anyway, because when they see me coming from some strange country and I've got weird stamps on my passport, they begin to do the process of putting me into detention. And then they call up something on the screen and they say, oh, actually, it's all right, Mr. Bowne. Enjoy your trip in the UK. And I'm like, okay, cheers.
I'm reading the book, I'm also curious to know what how you feel traveling the world through the view of race, because you are a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, in some instances, that's probably easier to get through to some of these places. But at the same time, you do raise suspicion, don't you?
Yeah, it's true. But I can sort of pass for what an Arab thinks maybe some other nearby person who's not quite Arab would be, or what an African maybe thinks an Arab would be. Like sometimes the black, I got ching-chonged a lot in Africa, actually. You know, when the Africans go ching-chong, ching-chong, because they think you're Chinese.
Yeah.
I mean, for them, any kind of pale skin is enough that they'll tease you for being Chinese, because they're the ones in China now. And so these racial things are a little bit fluid. I mean, also, when I was in Horn of Africa, the locals would think I was an Arab. Mm. And then when I was in, like I did in Iraq during the Second Gulf War, I dressed as an Iraqi and snuck in there and then tried to speak as little as possible so they wouldn't realize a foreigner. Because the battle was raging, and I was hitchhiking around watching the Americans battle against the Iraqis. But they kind of thought I must have been Azerbaijani or some other nationality like that. And, of course, when I got to Azerbaijan, I actually don't look like an Azerbaijani. But as long as I look like what an Iraqi thinks an Azerbaijani should look like, good enough.
So you do have to do some research in terms of knowing the context in which you're in before you get to some of these places, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And the odd thing about that research is it ends up, like, for a really difficult country. Like, there's some of them where people say it's undoable, and Somalia would be an example. Well, I began to research that, and I spent about 3 weeks on it. But at a certain point, I had to just go for it, because the more you research, the more you get points that fall on a graph, and it ends up being a bell curve. And at one end, you see people saying, you can't do it at all, you'll be instantly killed. At the other end, you have people saying, oh, it's fine, just go in. Then you have various ones in between, and it makes kind of a curve. But the more you research, the more dots you get on the curve. But it never deviates from that curve. It just becomes like a more filled-in curve. So at a certain point, you just got to go for it.
Yeah. The thing that you have to bring, obviously, is intuition, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is something I took away from living in the bush, because when you come out of the bush after not being around people for so long, it's so interesting that there's humans and human faces are looking at you, that you really concentrate strongly upon people's face and pay attention to the intonation of their words.
Mm.
And I felt that I kept some aspect of that with me, so I would be really, instead of concentrating on the language, which I usually didn't understand, I'd be looking at the faces and trying to see who's someone who's friendly, which is most people, but who's unfriendly as well, because you get a lot of people who'd, you know, they probably want to just stab you and, you know, take your passport.
Mm-hmm. You do learn a great deal about people, and I'm curious to know, Mike, if after all of your travels and all these people that you've encountered, people are generally the same, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, at first for traveling, I thought, wow, people are so different.
Uh-huh.
But then after a while, I realized that's just the veneer of culture on top of it, and deep down, we're all the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even quite unusual people like pygmies. You know, if you're seeing actually how they interact in the camp, after a while you go, oh yeah, it's like people in the suburb of Calgary or whatever. It's the same, right? The same family things going on. The same little bickerings between couples and all that. Yeah, it's all the same.
So then, do you understand why we fight with one another? Why there's conflict? Why there's war?
Yeah, I can see that as well, because you know a lot of it is things get pushed to a brink, because if each person is seeking advantage, they have to push it to the maximum to make sure they get the best possible deal. And of course, when you're pushing things to the brink, sometimes it goes over the brink, and you end up with trouble.
Yeah.
But I must say I'm a little bit, you know, when I'm back in Canada, it's a bit of culture shock. And I look what passes for news here, and unfortunately it passes for news in most countries. And it's mostly kind of fake news, but it's not the fake news that right-wing people are talking about. It's a different kind of fake news, where the understanding of what goes on geopolitically or in other cultures that's written about by people who are just going in there, they're parachuting in for a few days and then back to Canada. And it's actually like quite a low degree of understanding of what's going on in these foreign cultures.
Now, as someone who's lived amongst these many cultures, it must frustrate you that's how we here understand
that
stuff.
Yeah, like recently, for instance, I was hearing about the Americans are complaining that Russians were interfering with their election. Well, I've got some very good Afghan contacts, and one of them was just joking with me that he knew the outcome of the Afghan election before it happened. You know, the one where the general from the north,
right,
the vice president,
but
I forget the name of the president now. But he was drunk with an American official who was quite senior, and the guy spelled out entirely how the election would go, including at the end that the two people that were remaining were going to negotiate and what their names would be and how they make a power sharing. And it turned out exactly like that. So that was 6 months before the election.
So
it's a lot of what goes on is, you know, some of it's scripted, and it's not exactly the way that conspiracy theorists talk about, but there is a lot of that going on in the world.
So then in all of your travels, do you feel more at home in the world than, say, one place, like in Alberta where you are today, where you were born?
I think I feel more at home in places that are kind of like what Alberta used to be like.
Mm.
Like for instance, recently I was out in Ukraine, and it's kind of old-fashioned there. And it sort of reminds me of being like around Calgary in the mid-'80s or even the early 80s.
Huh. Yeah. The other thing that I was thinking about, Mike, as I was reading the book, was are there places in the world that are less touristy or have been untouched by tourism?
Yeah, there's some places where there's almost no tourists.
Where?
For instance, Republic of Congo. So this is just north of the DRC. There's almost no tourists in DRC.
Huh.
But Republic of Congo, even less toward the villages that are out in the hills. And there's one time I arrived in a village, and there was two factions of police in the police station beating each other bloody. And I eventually discovered that they were fighting over who would get the right to try to steal $10 from me. And normally I resist paying the $10, but in this case, you know, when the bloody-faced policeman came up who finally won the battle, you know, his faction had beaten the others,
yeah.
I decided to hand over the $10 rather than try to explain how I don't pay bribes. But then the funniest thing happened. He said, oh, there's another white man in town. Probably he's a friend of yours. And I'm like, okay, this is like the classic joke, right? You know, one other white man, I must know him, right? I've never even been to Republic of Congo before.
Yeah.
But then I walked over, and to the total non-surprise of all the Africans in the village, but the total surprise of me, it turned out I knew the guy. So I go, hey, he was the guy who was taking his bicycle all the way down Africa. And I diverged from him in Mauritania, and he'd continued south, and I'd gone over to the East Coast to pick up some of the wildlife migrations. And here I was swinging back west, and now I'd met him here in this town. We're like, hey, and the Africans are like, okay, that's normal. The two white guys know each other. And, yeah, so you get these funny coincidences sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that struck me is the need to cultivate compassion. And I mean, compassion is in such short supply in the world today. You just look at the leaders of some of these countries in the world today, let alone their citizens. Have you got a lesson in there or an answer as to how one must do that?
Yeah, I think you have to, like a lot of the people you meet are kind of like hillbillies,
mm-hmm.
or they're maybe like rednecks, and these are the more advanced ones that are like rednecks. Most of them are like hillbillies. So when you make a comparison between who you meet in the third world, you can't compare them across to, let's say, an office worker in Chicago or something. You have to compare it to like some Appalachian hillbilly. And when you do that, you can have more compassion for where they're coming from. Because they really, most people are very socially conservative, actually.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, sometimes you hear, especially from the left in Canada, they'll be very much against Trump supporters.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, fair enough, because he seems like he's got some brain trouble.
Sure.
But most people in the third world are actually more like Trump supporters. Like, they're very engaged in populism. They're not very educated. And, you know, I don't want to insult Trump supporters overly much, but I'm saying that most people around the third world are kind of in that mode. And they're very, very socially conservative.
Yeah.
So I found that in order to have compassion with these people and to be able to talk to them and sit with them and ask them what their concerns are, and they might be trying to explain to me why they need Sharia law in their village or whatever it is,
uh-huh.
you know, it enables me to also have compassion for people who have different political opinions back home in Canada.
Yeah. And the friends that you've made over the years, I mean, that's incalculable, isn't it?
Yeah, so many close friends.
Yeah.
I think it's one thing about the West is people tend not to have many friends. Like this nuclear family thing has maybe been carried too far, and people might not even know their neighbors. But in a lot of these countries, the sort of like the extended family and the lifelong friends are still intact. And the sense of fun as well. Like when I was living with the Bambudi pygmy tribe in the center of the jungle in Congo, several times a day they'd be rolling around on the ground with laughter, so much that they're holding their bellies. And I thought, well, I very seldom see Canadians doing that.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's a little bit sad because, you know, they sure do. I mean, maybe their life is a bit shorter than ours, but they certainly make the most of it.
Yeah. You also have this marvelous ability to when you meet people, most people, to get on with them quite well. And it's fun for you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love hearing about different viewpoints like that. So. Yeah, and even sometimes quite strange viewpoints. So I could get along with almost anyone, I think.
Yeah. What's the way for if you have to give us a tip into how to do that? I mean, at a bar, say drinking, or at a meal. I mean, what's the easiest way to get on with people?
I find that I start by listening.
Mm.
So I'll spend a lot of time listening to where they're coming from. And it helps that I'm not traveling in a highfalutin way where I'm dressed very fancy and I'm in the 4-star hotel and all that. So for instance, I spent quite a lot of time hanging out in the refugee camps in northern Africa and even the ones next to Syria. And I would also be, you know, a guy with a grubby backpack trying to scrounge a way to get my way across the border somehow. And so are all the guys in the camp. So we're talking to the same people, smugglers. You know, I was having some trouble with my French. They'd be saying things like, you know, pay me $200 and I'll have you picking cucumbers in Spain within a month.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, well, I didn't quite want to go that far. But yeah, because I'm in the same situation, I'm living with, you know, directly with them in the same camps. They'll tell me all the stories of how they're trying to get across Africa, or even I hear some quite strange stories. Like I met this one guy who was a former Tuareg rebel commander.
Mm.
And because I'm sort of in the same situation as him, he's really able to open up to me. And I was saying, well, how do you afford your war? Because war is one of the most expensive things on earth. And you guys are a bunch of Tuaregs, like you have a bunch of camels. They're worth about $600 each. And you certainly can't get rid of them. You need them.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, what we do is we would send some boys to watch these mysterious trucks that are driving north across Africa. And when they'd come to an oasis to try to get water, the boys would use their cell phones to call the rest of the Tuaregs, and we'd gather and capture the truck. And he said invariably it was filled with sacks of cocaine.
Huh.
So then they would take the cocaine ransom, and they'd say, unless you pay us, I mean, I think they started with $3 million or something, and they went up to six. Anyway, it was millions of dollars. Then you won't see your cocaine again. And they get the guys to leave the sacks of money at a part in the desert, and they then give the GPS coordinates to leave the cocaine. So in a way, they were funding it through, I guess in a way it comes from the drug war, because
yeah.
We're trying to prevent that kind of thing, and as a result, it's a very high price for it. So they're using that to fund a lot of the war. And I found that a lot of these wars around the world, even the Afghan one, is a drug war as well. Most of them are.
Yeah. You cut it close any time in your travels? I mean, did you think you'd buy it at any point?
Well, I was a little bit worried, like when doing Iraq one time when I was, a guy picked me up hitchhiking,
uh-huh.
And he was a big fan of Saddam Hussein. So he said, oh, Tikrit. You know, we were just driving past the town of Tikrit, and that's Saddam's hometown where all
yeah.
his tribe would live. And he pulled in, and he insisted we sit at this outdoor chicken and rice restaurant. And he was speaking to me in English, so I had to speak back in English. And I could see all of Saddam's tribesmen giving me the evil eye.
Mm.
And I was thinking, oh, no, are they going to come and chop off my head? But luckily they didn't.
Yeah.
And I had a few roads I took in Afghanistan as well that were quite dodgy, because often I had a choice between a 30% chance of death road or an 80%. And I went with the 30, but I had to take it twice. And luckily, I didn't get killed there either.
What a way to look at life, though, isn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's all, I think it's worth it. You know, it's worth it to take a risk. I mean, the thing is, some people say, oh, you take so many risks, Mike, you so many risks. And maybe I look at him, and he's sitting in, like, a comfy chair eating tons of cheeseburgers just watching TV, and I think, well, that's a bigger risk. You can get heart disease from that, right? So, I don't know. I'm trying to take fun kind of risks.
Yeah. So you mentioned a moment ago about some of these places that you've stayed at. So how do you deal with sleep? Because there's obviously ambient noise. That's natural from whatever surroundings you might be in, but also man-made. You know, so some of these places like hostels that you stay in, they can be quite loud. How are you able to knock off at night?
Yeah, I think I became a bit more accustomed to that, because when I was going through Europe, some of my friends went out to gigantic festivals.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go, and sometimes they would sneak in, but I usually paid. And there you're just sort of camping out, and it might be, you know, tons and tons of bands, and this thing goes on for days and days. People hardly sleep. So I've sort of got used to it a bit more from that. Because I certainly wasn't used to that from my previous living in the wilderness. You know, I was used to complete silence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just may do as well. You know, the thing is, you can take a nap as well. There's low stress when you're traveling. As long as you don't mind the risk, then you can really relax and have low stress. And if you need to nap on a bus, it's all good.
Yeah. So you've done all the countries down the world. What's the next adventure? Do you find yourself wanting to go back to certain places, say?
Well, now I'm taking advantage of where I see there's a difference between what the public thinks is true and what is really true. Now here's an example. Like on the year 2000, New Year's, everyone was saying the planes are going to drop out of the sky.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's unlikely. Why would a plane drop out of the sky? It seems silly. So I got some ticket for nearly nothing flying over to Asia, like a 10 or 12-hour flight. And it was basically just me on the plane, so I was stretched out across all these seats. And the stewardess just said, you know, just call for food whenever you want. You're practically the only person on the plane. So here I was taking advantage of something where the public had a perception of extreme danger, but the extreme danger wasn't real. And so now I find I'm going to a lot of countries where there's very few tourists, so you can really get around and see things without being bothered, or the locals are still kind of excited that there's a tourist there, because there's not too many tourists kind of in their hair annoying them.
Yeah.
And the reason there'd be so few is because the public would have a perception that the place is too dangerous. And so an example would be Ukraine once again. I was out there for 2 months this summer traveling around. And everyone thinks because of the war that you can't go there. But really, the war is only in that one section quite far away, so it's near the Russian border. And the rest of it, like the Carpathian Mountains or even Kyiv or Dnipropetrovsk, you can go there no problem.
Yeah. And is it true that, you know, when you hear of, say, a bombing somewhere, and people say automatically, well, I'm not going to go there anymore, one does go there and it's fine? I mean...
Yeah, I would often, if I hear about a bombing, I'd often think, okay, I want to go there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the other tourists are clearing out.
Yeah.
So they have an easy time getting low-cost hotels.
Mm.
Yeah, so I was actually near a bombing once. For in Kabul, there was a suicide bomber. I could feel the pressure wave move through my body.
Really?
Yeah, I've had a few. But otherwise, I wasn't too close. But I guess in Mogadishu, there was tank shells exploding, like going overhead. Yeah. But other than that, I've managed to avoid bombings.
So this obviously gives you a perspective on life that others might not have, and so I mean, the way one lives one's life. I mean, you obviously calculate risk and the sort, but what do? Do you just go for it if you feel like it? Or?
I always go for it because I see too many people living as if, like, imagine someone said to you, okay, here's your practice life, and then after that we'll do the real life.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not the situation. But imagine if that was the situation. I see a lot of people living as if this is their practice life and not their real life.
Mm.
When really, like, if not now, when are you going to go have some fun and adventures? You know, you get this one go-around. So I'm just trying to make the best of it, basically.
Yeah. The other thing, packing light, obviously, one has to do that to get around. And I read recently that not too long ago, it's not too long ago that you got a cell phone finally, right?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, I had to get a cell phone and learn how to use it. Yeah, and I never had a cell phone before because, you know, I've even had friends killed for cell phones.
Yeah, see, that's the other thing that I was thinking about. You go to some of these places, that's very valuable to someone else.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. We don't think about that. I mean, I hate to think of some people that I know would end up going to some place and, you know, they can't get rid of their phone or, they have to have their phone with them. I mean, you get them killed, right?
Yeah, it can be a bad habit. I mean, there's one guy that was coming to see me in Kyiv recently, and I found out later he got beaten up by muggers and had his phone taken. But he'd arrived at the train station, and then he got out, and he's in these black alleys, and he couldn't find out where he was. So he just pulled out his cell phone to use Google to find out where he was.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, then you're in a dark alley with vagrants and stuff, and they see your glowing phone.
Yeah.
It's a problem. And then I had another friend was recently killed by his yoga teacher in northern India. And that was to steal his phone as well.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, see, that's a perspective that we get when we read this book about sort of the habits we have and how in another context, in another place, these things, you know, are dangerous.
Yeah, you can't give off the impression that you have a lot of money. So that's why I've used the same, I mean, my backpack never got stolen, but I've used the same backpack all these years. And it's very shabby looking now, luckily.
Mm-hmm.
And even when muggers are trying to choose who they're going to steal from, they're going to steal with the one that has the glowing new, like most people's backpacks are glowing new things. They heard they use them, so they practically look like they're off the shelf.
Yeah.
And these are the ones that the thieves are going to target. Whereas my shabby old pack, you know, often gets mistaken for some local's pack. And in fact, truthfully, there was nothing in it. So I didn't even have computers or, you know, maybe there's a few books on different languages and a mosquito net and some old clothes.
Yeah. Mosquito net, is that the thing that one needs to have with them or wherever they go?
Yeah, you pretty much need a mosquito net, and you got to go for the box kind, and not the one with the split in it that makes it easy to get in and out of bed.
Out, yeah.
Yeah, because the mosquitoes will also find that little split in it, and they'll come through and give you malaria.
Mm.
Yeah, but you can often tell if you got malaria because it's, you get a few, like if you're paying attention to your body, you can kind of figure it out because you start having trouble crossing the roads.
Mm.
And especially in Africa, you've got to run across enormous highways and kind of stop and let cars zip by you in all directions.
Yeah.
So at high speed. And then when you look for a space, you can move forward. So it's kind of difficult sometimes to cross the major roads. And when you got malaria, the first sign of it is that you have trouble with that.
Mm.
And then the second sign is the mosquitoes start coming in and trying to bite you because it changes your smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, you get the crushing headache. And I'm actually immune to headaches, but you can still feel the pressure from it.
Yeah. This is such a fascinating book. I could talk to you all day about this, Mike.
Thanks. It's been a fun conversation.
Yeah, and there's so many other than say, you know, the travel aspect of it and getting places and seeing all these fascinating places. I mean, there are marvelous lessons here about how to talk to people in terms of, you know, being from different places and different cultures. And I think you teach us in this book how to do that a little bit better. And if we ever find ourselves in a different country, it makes it a lot easier for us.
Yeah. I was trying to help out people who want to do similar things and backpack around. So if you really try to be listen carefully and be understanding, you can even understand why people do the strangest things or they have cultural practices that wouldn't make sense here. But, you know, when you really listen to them, you can figure out why they're doing that. And in some cases, they do have to change what they're doing slowly over time. But you can get a sense of why they do it originally.
And
most people are really, really good people. Like, for instance, even in Papua New Guinea, where, you know, I had to be very careful. And, for instance, there was a woman burned at the stake for witchcraft in one of the towns I was passing through, as I was passing through it. And I saw all other kinds of violence, like Stone Age tribesmen-type violence in the highlands. But it was only a minority of people who were doing that. Yeah. Even in a place that's notorious for violence, it was just a couple percent that were doing that. And the rest of the people were extraordinarily kind. So, like, for instance, I was staying, to try to save money, I was staying at Seventh Adventist guest houses, where they had their missionaries would stay there.
Yeah.
But when a bus was coming into town, the Papuans would make sure the bus, instead of going to the bus station, it would drive me first to the place I was staying. Then all the men would get out, and they'd walk with me and make sure I got to this guest house and make sure I was in the door and everything was fine, and then they'd wave and say bye and go back to their bus and continue on to where was supposed to be the regular stop of the bus.
Oh.
So it's just extraordinary effort to try to keep a foreigner safe and make sure he had a good time in their country.
Wasn't that also the country where there was a very high level of domestic abuse?
Yeah. So I saw one woman being battered by her husband and things. They have an extreme problem with that. And I think it might even have changed the shape of the jaws of the women. Like, you notice the Papuan women, especially in the highlands, have quite a strong jaw. And I think it might have evolved, or this jaw might have evolved over tens of thousands of years. Because they're dealing with such brutality from their warrior husbands that if they had a small jaw, it would get shattered and they'd be likely to die.
Yeah. And there's a great lesson there, too, about what to do when you see something like that.
Yeah, and I found that I had to be very careful not to make things worse. Because the heroic thing to do if you see a situation, like for instance, a situation I saw that seemed worse was there seemed to be an altercation out the bus, and I'm kind of crammed in there with all the locals, but I'm looking out and I can see that it looked like a guy beating up a woman after stripping the baby out of her arms. He was beating her up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw other people from the village rushing over, and I guess they were his friends because they actually assisted in beating his wife.
Mm.
And then I was considering what to do, and actually the proper response here, unfortunately, was nothing. Because, you know, I had no extra money, I had no ability to stop there, I had no ability to speak their language. So if I had tried to assist, I probably would have just made the situation worse. Because then the warrior husband would have thought that he had been disrespected in front of everyone by having a white man try to chastise him.
Yeah.
And then because I'm not there to protect this woman and can't afford it, and I can't afford the time or anything to do it, she'd probably get like a double beating later that night.
Yeah.
So in some situations, you have to just let it slide.
Yeah. I reached you today in Canmore. You're out hiking, out and about. Is that the closest to home for you?
Yeah, I think it is, and that in Okotoks. I have one brother in Okotoks and one in Canmore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's fun to go out hiking there. Like, I saw the leg of a deer on the trail a little bit earlier, and and I heard coyotes before that, so I thought, oh, the coyotes have got a deer. And I was thinking I was going to go back and get one of my brother's little dogs and bring it out and then see if he can hold up the leg of the deer. I was going to make, like, a funny photo because now I have a smartphone so I can take photos.
Yeah.
But by the time I came back, the coyotes had dragged off the deer leg. So no joke photo was possible.
Yeah. Well, I hope a lot of people pick up this book because, as I said, there are marvelous lessons in here, not only on how to travel but how to deal with people, how to communicate with people. And you've done a marvelous job in bringing us the world in this book. So congratulations on this, Mike, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been a really fun conversation.
The book is called The World's Most Traveled Man, A 23-Year Odyssey to and Through Every Country on the Planet. Douglas & McIntyre is its publisher. Mike Spencer-Bowen joined me on the line from Kenmore, Alberta, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.